This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Congressional Democrats say it's coming. The chairman of the Fed says it's coming. And today the president made it official. Some kind of economic stimulus is on the way. Now all that's left is the politicking. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Friday. It's the 18th of January today, and it didn't take the president but 5 minutes this morning to announce what we all knew was coming.
To keep our economy growing and creating jobs, Congress and the administration need to work to enact an economic growth package as soon as possible.
He was careful not to steal his own thunder. The White House has been saying for a week or so we won't get any details of what the president wants, stimulus-wise, until the State of the Union at the end of the month. But we did get some hints. Mr. Bush said today he wants about 1% of GDP's worth of stimulus. That's about $140 billion. And he wants it mostly in the form of tax cuts. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale takes it from there.
President Bush wouldn't say exactly what kind of tax breaks he favors. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson says that's because the White House is open to suggestions from Congress. Democrats are targeting tax breaks and spending at lower-income families. But the chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers, Edward Lazier, says low-income benefits are not the White House priority.
There are many noble goals, and there are many things that we want the government to do. But remember that the goal that we are thinking about right now is to ensure that the economy does not slow significantly. We're trying to make sure that growth is enhanced.
To encourage companies to grow and hire, the Business Roundtable today urged President Bush to remember tax reductions for businesses. One idea that worked in 2002, says the Roundtable's John Castellani, is to allow businesses to write off their investments in factories and equipment more quickly.
It begins immediately. It has a positive cash flow effect as soon as you make the investment.
Treasury Secretary Paulson says he's ready to act as soon as lawmakers agree.
And I can tell you, when we get the legislation, we're going to run like a bunny here to get the relief out.
But don't look for cash rebate checks anytime soon. Former IRS Commissioner Sheldon Cohen says the agency is swamped as it is.
They're in the middle of gearing up for filing season right now. And you don't want to stop that process for the other one. That would be counterproductive.
Cohen says it'll be June at the earliest, assuming lawmakers pass a relatively simple set of tax breaks. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There's some discussion out there about whether or not we might be in a recession already. To judge by the stock market, the bad times are upon us now. Since New Year's Day, the Dow has dropped nearly 10%. That's almost enough right there to officially qualify as a market correction all by itself. Of course, if you ask money managers, they're saying what they always say, sit tight and wait out the storm. For a lot of Americans, though, sitting tight just doesn't feel like an option, as Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Being an investor these days is getting downright scary.
I'm writing it out, but I'm reasonably worried right now.
Steve Goldstein is a retired government employee, and he's living off of his retirement account. Its value has dropped about 10% since last year. He says the markets have him in a bind.
If it does drop precipitously, I'm not sure what I can do, because once it drops precipitously, it doesn't make sense to get out.
But a lot of investors think it does right now. They've started yanking money out of stocks and stashing it into safer havens like treasury bonds. Musician Ed Boyle has moved a major chunk of his savings into gold.
I'm not buying gold to make a profit. I'm buying gold as a hedge. I hope I'm wily enough to maybe make some money someplace else, but just I don't know how right now.
And some people are opting for their mattresses. Retiree Margaret Klein Harmon moved her savings out of stocks about 9 months ago. If she hadn't, her portfolio would have lost more than half its value. She says she won't venture back into the markets anytime soon.
I really don't think it's going to be safe to put your money in it for 5 or 6 years, but once it stabilizes, I might.
Michael Farr is chief investment officer of Farr Miller in Washington. He says there aren't a lot of Margarets out there yet.
These emotional mindsets evolve. I think that things could get worse.
Farr says people shouldn't indulge their fears. He says this slump may last for a few years, but the markets will recover.
Be dispassionate and think about the long term. And if you don't look now, that'd be a really good strategy.
Also known as the ignorance is bliss strategy. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Earlier this week, the Food and Drug Administration ruled meat and milk from cloned animals is as safe as anything else to eat. Now, the state of Pennsylvania has jumped into the food safety debate. Regulators there were set to ban milk carton labels, saying the contents come from cows not treated with growth hormones. About a third of all American dairy cows are treated with what's called BGH to make the cows produce more milk. But yesterday, Governor Ed Randell approved more modest labeling guidelines instead. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner explains.
Pennsylvania's agriculture secretary argued that non-BGH labels imply that milk from cows not treated with growth hormone is somehow better or safer, and the FDA, he noted, has declared that not so. But the state's decision to ban those labels provoked a backlash from consumer groups and some dairy farmers. Dairyman Dan Rice was among them.
I'm not against technology or use of technology, but I think the consumer should be given a choice.
BGH manufacturer Monsanto has fought hard against non-BGH labels. It's appealed to the Federal Trade Commission and even sued individual dairies over the issue. But increasingly, retailers are phasing out BGH milk, including Starbucks, Kroger's, and even Walmart. Walmart's private label milk, that is. They say they're simply responding to consumer demand. But in a recent interview, Monsanto's Michael Doan said milk drinkers are being duped.
Misleading labels actually damage the reputation of all dairy products by suggesting there's good milk or bad milk, and that's really not true.
BGH makes up a small part of Monsanto's revenues, but food scholar Marion Nessel says if the company can't stem the backlash against BGH,
then maybe they'll have a consumer backlash against genetically modified soybeans and corn, which are Monsanto's big money makers.
A few other states, including Ohio, are considering labeling bans similar to the one Pennsylvania just rescinded. Pennsylvania will still require the labels to carry an FDA disclaimer. It states there's no significant difference between the two kinds of milk. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Investors probably could have used a shot of something way stronger than milk this week. We'll have the details, and we'll call that stockbroker down in Dallas when we do the numbers. The North American International Auto Show has been going on this week in Detroit. It's a huge opportunity for car makers to generate some much-needed excitement. Ford, in particular, would love to spark some buzz. The company that gave us the Model T and the Mustang has been losing market share for years. It is now third behind General Motors and Toyota in the number of vehicles sold in this country.
The boss will see you now.
And so this month's Conversation from the Corner Office takes us to Dearborn, Michigan, to talk to the guy whose job it is to turn Ford around. Alan Mulally spent 37 years making airplanes at Boeing. He's been running Ford for the past 15 months or so. And when we sat down, he admitted he's got his work cut out for him.
we are a little bit behind where we maybe could have been. The hard times, clearly there's an aspect of that that's associated with our strategy of staying in the big trucks and SUVs a little bit too long, maybe not appreciating as well as we could that the fuel prices were going to stay up, that the consumer was going to continue to move towards smaller cars and utility vehicles.
There was a lot of speculation and analysis when you got this job. That part of the reason you got it was because you had been so successful in your time at Boeing. And the hope, I guess, was that you'd be able to do the same thing here. I'm wondering, though, if cars and airplanes really are that similar. I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, baseball and football are both sports, but they're completely different.
Sure, I understand. And a big part of my decision to join Ford was the fact that I really believe that my experiences in 37 years in the airplane business would be so transferable to Ford, and I'd actually be able to help and make an immediate impact.
Let me do a little point-counterpoint here, though, okay? First of all, this is not now presently Ford, a profitable company. You don't have to worry about maybe a couple of dozen customers as Boeing did. You have to worry about millions and millions of customers. I mean, when people think about buying a car, it's money out of their, straight out of their pockets.
To me, one of the most important things in business is to know what reality is, what the business environment really is. And, you know, clearly the market has changed dramatically. Plus, we have a lot of headwinds with the economy and the housing and the unemployment and the subprime and the credit tightening. So the most important thing about the plan is to reduce the production of the new vehicles to the real demand. And in the automobile industry, especially the three Detroit companies, that has not been their plan. They would keep production up, they'd discount the vehicles, and they'd wait for another day. So the most important part of the plan is to move aggressively and size the business to the lower demand in the near term.
You're happy with a smaller market share so long as it gets you back to profitability?
Absolutely. Because the purpose of business is to create value. And it's not about market share, it's not about size, it's about creating value. Great companies are profitable because that allows you to fund the new product development. If you go into a cycle and you keep your production up and you discount the vehicles and you lose money, then you lose your ability to keep investing to come out of the cycle in a positive way. So as hard as this is, the most important thing is to deal with the reality, take the aggressive action, and keep investing for the future.
Give me an honest appraisal of your time here. Do you think you're moving fast enough with the restructuring plan? And do you think you're going to be able to get it done by 2009, which is when you promised to come back to profitability?
We're absolutely on plan to return to profitability in 2009. And we're going to keep taking decisive action to get there no matter what happens. Now, it's easier if the economy doesn't slow down too much more. But we're on plan to achieve that objective. That's the number one objective because that fuels our growth going forward.
Do you think Ford has bottomed out yet?
Well, I think the answer to that question goes a lot with the current economy, not just in the United States, but worldwide, because we have been gradually slowing our market share decline because we've been starting to add in the new smaller and mid-sized cars and utilities to complement the bigger SUVs and the trucks. And so we're getting a portfolio now that's allowing us to arrest the market share decline. And with a few more vehicles in the smaller size, then I think we'll get a chance to profitably grow. The exact timing of that over this next couple of years is going to be very dependent on the economy worldwide. But we're taking the right actions for the long term.
Alan Mulally is the president and CEO of the Ford Motor Company. Mr. Mulally, thanks a lot for your time.
Glad to be here.
There's more of my interview with Alan Mulally, as well as conversations from other corner offices online. Our website is marketplace.org. It is time to check the week on Wall Street, and what a week it was with that guy. We do that with David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Man, you got off easy today, didn't you?
Not present, sir.
Yeah.
Not here.
You'd like to run away, wouldn't you?
Keep going. Next in line. Oh, yeah, we did get off easy. We weren't down triple digits. We were only down, what, 60 points today? Well, we were down triple digits for a while. We were up triple digits for a while. Did you see the volume today?
Yeah, it was crazy, wasn't it?
I mean, it's almost 2.5 billion shares. We've had over 2 billion shares the last couple of days. You would think that they would run out of stock to sell.
You would hope, I imagine. What's going on here, man? I mean, is it just more of the same?
Yeah, I mean, it's more of the same. They keep digging up bad news, and we keep finding new excuses to sell off. The interesting thing is we're evidently just losing faith in our national leaders. We had a triple-digit rally going in this market this morning until, and it was coincidental, I'm sure, until the president started talking about the stimulus program. And the market just sort of rolled over and headed south, and as gauged by the Dow, went from a triple-digit gain to a triple-digit loss. And we were kind of down yesterday. Then all of a sudden, we started hearing from Ben Bernanke, the current chairman of the Fed, and the thing just started dropping like a rock. We went from down 80 to maybe down 300 or
yeah,
so.
But riddle me this. They are saying things that one would think everybody would want to hear, that we're going to get some kind of stimulus package.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't hear this so much on Wall Street as I do on Main Street, but I'm beginning to hear it on Wall Street. I don't think they like Ben Bernanke.
Really?
And I don't know if it's grounded in, you know, in good fact, or if it's just always convenient to have somebody to blame.
Well, hold it. Let me ask the pointed question here. Do they not like him because they don't think he's doing a good job?
They don't like him because the market's dropping like a rock. Have you noticed?
Yes, actually, I have. Thank you very much. Seriously,
I think a lot of the talk I hear on Wall Street is he's behind the curve. They never should have let this happen. That he just doesn't instill confidence. He didn't earn it. That's a lot of this job is jawboning, that sort of stuff. And I don't know, you know, out of the cocktail party circuit, it's just people coming up and saying it's all his fault. Hadn't been any good since he got there.
Yeah, you go to boring cocktail parties, man, if you're talking about interest rates.
Well, you know, that's all they talk to me about. Well, usually they shoot the messenger. I'm just happy they talk to me at all. Now, this week was interesting. There were several new developments. I mean, one is, I guess it was maybe late last week, AT&T came out and said people aren't paying their phone bills.
Did you
see the story from Sprint today?
Yeah, no, I did. It's interesting.
Yeah, it is, because, I mean, they're eliminating 4,000 jobs and closing a bunch of stores. You know, Kai, I'm telling you, I don't care how bad the economy is out there. You know, I'm going to pay my phone bill. You know what I think we need?
I would say a three-day weekend.
There you go. Yeah. You're reading my mind.
All in favor, say aye. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Aye. Have a good weekend.
Coming up, heady hopes for the rebirth of a New Orleans institution.
We were in a little hotel room, and our granddaughter called us, you know, Papa, Papa, come quick. There's Dixie. And sure enough, there was a boat passing by the brewery.
Beer coming up for a three-day weekend. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street, I guess, didn't think much of the president's stimulus package today. The Dow Industrials gave up 0.5%, 59 points, closed at 12,099. The NASDAQ slipped 0.3%, 6 points, to end at 2340. The S&P 500 lost 0.6%, 8 points, to finish the day at 1325. For the week that it was, both the Dow and the NASDAQ lost 4%. The S&P 500 lost 0.5%. The insurance giant AIG tumbled 4% today. Bank of America dropped 2.5%. Sprint Nextel lost more than 24% after the company admitted it lost more than 500,000 subscribers last quarter. General Electric gained 3% on news of a 15% profit. Overseas, London's FTSE traded pretty much flat. France's CAC 40 fell 1.25%. The German DAX gave up 1.33%. Bonds traded up. The yield on the 10-year T-note slid to 3.63%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. Today is Martin Luther King Day. The Corporation for National and Community Service begins its 40-day social justice project to honor Dr. King. The Congressional Black Caucus Institute holds a Democratic presidential primary debate in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And the markets will be closed for the holiday. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The presidential campaign goes south this weekend. Not South Carolina, although that'll be important too. Cubans vote on Sunday for members of the National Assembly. It's the first step in picking a new president once Fidel, you know. Over the past year and a half, Raul Castro has run that country. He's widely seen as more pragmatic than his older brother, which has sparked hope that economic change may be on the horizon. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
On Sunday, Cubans will elect the 609 members of the National Assembly. Many people question how democratic this election really will be. The delegates are running unopposed. They were selected by a process controlled by the Communist Party, and they're aligned with the Castro government. In March, the National Assembly will name the nation's president. And Cuba experts uniformly predict that for the first time in 50 years, Cuba's president won't be a Castro.
Well, there's only one leading contender.
Carlos Laje.
It's Carlos Laje.
Carlos Laje is in his early 50s, pediatrician by training.
He's long been the second vice president of Cuba. He's known as their economics czar.
Laje, in reality, is already a kind of de facto prime minister.
That was Jaime Suchlicki, Phil Peters, Kirby Jones, and Brian Littell. Littell, a former intelligence officer, wrote the book After Fidel.
That somebody else soon will probably be filling that position, if not his shoes, it's really quite an historical event.
Does this mean the Castros will simply fade away? Don't bet on it, says Jaime Suchlicki with the University of Miami. He says Raul Castro simply doesn't like the spotlight of the presidency.
Carlos Laje is going to be a puppet of Raul Castro. He is not going to be an independent actor. And when everybody asks me, well, why doesn't Laje have any power as being the president of Cuba, my answer is, how many tanks does he have?
Raul, a four-star general, has run Cuba's armed forces for 49 years, longer than any other defense minister in the world. The military also controls the tourism industry, Cuba's main economic engine.
The military is running more than 50% of the economy. The security apparatus is under the military control and under Raul. So therefore, that's the real power in Cuba.
Antonio Jorge grew up with Fidel Castro and served for 16 months as Cuba's vice minister of finance. He says Sunday's election, along with Raul Castro's year-long public conversation on economic reform, aren't about change. They're about the appearance of change. The real aim of this exercise? To end the U.S. embargo.
Raul Castro will try to portray this as a true populist political process in which, after extensive discussion of the weaknesses and defects and shortcomings of the regime, now we have a general election and people participate to the tune of 99%. So what more can the U.S. ask for?
After all, Cuba would have held elections, and neither Castro ended up as president. For Cuba, ending the embargo would mean more than an influx of U.S. tourists. It would pave the way for the IMF, the World Bank, and others to begin lending money to Cuba.
So Cuba would have a few billion dollars coming its way, and that will be a lifeline for the regime.
It's a lifeline that won't be thrown by the Bush administration, as the State Department's Kirsten Madison made clear this week at a conference on Cuba.
Just to sort of preempt everyone who's gearing up to ask the usual question about why don't we just lift the embargo, I want to underscore that we want our businesses to engage in Cuba at a time and in a circumstance that they will be able to reinforce and support a process of change, not reinforce a repressive state.
Still, Brian Littell says a thaw may be coming. 1 year from now, the U.S. will have a new president. Cuba will have a new president.
Maybe there will be possibilities for very, very profound change in this 50-year stalemated relationship.
In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
It's not just housing and manufacturing in this country that are slowing down. Beer sales are off, too. The South African brewing giant SABMiller reported slower than expected sales growth this week. It owns Miller Lite and Henry Weinhard's, among others. But SAB's got it easy compared to much smaller microbrewers that count sales practically by the case. Until Hurricane Katrina ripped through the brewery, Dixie Beer was a mainstay down in New Orleans. It's being made in Wisconsin for the time being. I asked owner Kendra Bruno how she and her husband Joe are bringing their beer back to market.
Well, first we had to brew it, and we have just started rolling out trucks of beer in September.
How does that feel?
It feels wonderful. It's been such a long time.
Remind us what happened, would you?
Well, we've been here for 100 years, and along came Katrina. Then all of a sudden we weren't in business between the hurricane and the flood and the looters. We lost a few million dollars worth of equipment. We lost every piece of memorabilia. We lost Rolodexes, contacts.
Down to the very copper brewing kettle, right?
We lost that and miles of copper pipes and tubes. That was the looters. But we were able to stop the looters, and we did end up with a few tanks left that we have now hidden and stored.
Was there a moment after the hurricane where you said, the heck with it, we just can't do this, it's too hard?
Right after the hurricane, we had no idea for a while. We had evacuated over to Houston, and we had no idea if there was anything left, if we had a home. We had no idea. But there was never a thought, what the heck, give it up. Actually, we were in a little hotel room, and our granddaughter called us, you know, Papa, Papa, come quick, there's Dixie. And sure enough, there was a boat passing by the brewery. So at that point, we knew it was still standing. And no matter what else had happened, there was something to save, and we could start again.
Retail space, of course, is hard to come by in the beer business, and you've been out of there. You've been off shelves, really, for a couple of years. How are you going to go about getting it back on store shelves?
That's the hard part. You need contacts. You need public demand. We don't even have a website. We're a little slow on the draw on that. But the ways people have found us has been absolutely incredible. So there is a market. There's a loyal fan base, even though we haven't been on the shelves. We're going to inch our way back on.
So be honest with me now. Does it taste as good now that it's made in Wisconsin as it did when it was made in New Orleans?
Not quite.
Yeah.
We're missing just a teeny bit of the magic, but we'll get it back.
Soon enough. Kendra Bruno is the co-owner with her husband, Joseph, of the Dixie Brewing Company. Ms. Bruno, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, if you're planning a plane trip anytime soon, expect to pay more. Major U.S. airlines played a little follow the leader today. Delta, United, and Continental all raised their fuel surcharges. They're matching American Airlines, which announced yesterday that its fuel fees are doubling to $40 per round trip. The root cause of it all, crude oil, has traded lower this week, though there was a bump today to $90.57 a barrel for the black gold stuff. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow fell 59 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ lost 6 points. That's about 0.3%. The S&P 500 dropped 8 points, 0.6% there. Remember, the equities markets are closed on Monday. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yor. Coming up next time on the program, France's favorite pickle. It's a rough patch.
There's really a broad range of fruits and vegetables that now are more and more imported rather than produced locally.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.